Welcome to a Strategy and Business podcast. I'm Art Kleiner, Editor-in-Chief of Strategy and Business. Ever since World War II, people have looked ahead to a variety of effects from artificial intelligence. These effects range from the loss of jobs to incredible new jobs to dystopian control, and then some. But very few people have looked systematically at what really happens to human systems, machines, processes, practices, businesses, and even cities, when digital intelligence enters the picture. John Sfiocla has. In his day job, John is principal for PwC United States and the U.S. marketing leader for PwC, which, full disclosure, gives him a role in helping determine the evolution of Strategy and Business, our publication. But he is also the author of a major work in progress on sentient systems. Today, we asked John to talk about his research, together with Laura Starita, who is working with him in putting these ideas together. Laura is the co-founder of the communications firm Sono Partners. What's actually going on? What's happening today that is worth writing yet another book about digital technology?
Well, what's interesting about what's happening today is that we're starting to get sophisticated enough systems that they're actually becoming self-aware and actually displaying sentient behavior. I think we should dig a little bit into sentience, at least what I mean by it, which is I believe something is sentient if it can sense its environment and its state, make changes to itself so it behaves differently, and has a symbolic representation of its behavior. So those are the components. It's easy to talk about AI and things like that at kind of an abstract level, but when you get down to it, it's very tricky. And the reason it's tricky is that once we understand things, we don't think it's intelligent anymore. So you take a look at something like the form that you fill out when you get a credit card, okay, where you put in your location, your earnings, your debt, and so forth. Well, all those activities used to actually be done by a bank manager. You know, when I got my first home loan, I got it from a guy by the name of Morris Sullivan, who my uncle the priest used to put money in Morris's bank in Alston. Anyway, so Morris gave me a character loan, right? He knew I had a good family. He thought I'd pay it back. Well, what you do now is you go and you fill out the form, they give it to an algorithm to create a FICO score, and they make the decision based on that. But when you walk into the bank, you don't walk in and say, oh my goodness, what a smart form, right? Now that it's codified, you don't think of it as intelligent. So it's a slippery slope that you have to be careful about. A good way to navigate a more sophisticated example is the Google car, the autonomous car, whether it's from Google or Audi or whomever. But let's take the Google one for a minute. Chris Urmson, the head of engineering at Google, came to one of our events and told a story about when they first did the Google car. They had four pieces of information. They had maps, the Google Maps. They had GPS off the satellites. They had onboard radar. And they also had some cameras around the car. And they had an enormous amount of computer power in the car. With those four things and the computer power, they were able to compute driving down to a 3-foot error. Now, I grew up in Brockton, Mass. I live in Boston. You can maybe get away with a 3-foot error if you're driving in Boston because we're such terrible drivers there. But you really can't deploy a device like that.
Well, forgive me. What's a 3-foot error?
A 3-foot error means that the car, instead of being in the lane, it would be outside the lane by 3 feet, either toward the oncoming car or toward the guardrail.
Right. And so, in other words, more than I ever want, even with my own intelligence driving the car, I don't want a 3-foot error.
You don't want a 3-foot error. Okay. No. I mean, you'd be, you know, if they're coming past each other, you know, you can have a 6-foot overlap and a head-on collision, right? So obviously not good enough. So what they did is they added a LiDAR on top, which is a laser rangefinder. And if you've seen the Google car, you see this funky looking thing, looks like a bent roll of toilet paper on the top, and that spins around. What that does is it has a laser in it that scans up and down as it spins around, and it paints and collects 1.5 million pieces of data per second. Okay, when they added that fifth piece of data to the cameras, the radar, the maps, and the GPS, and the compute power, what they're able to do is to compute in real time a three-dimensional model of reality that the car then drives through with great, great accuracy. Now, what you have here is the allocation of decision rights that used to be in a human's brain, now in the car. And actually, in some of the new models, the Tesla, the Audi, and others, you actually have the ability to dynamically allocate that that sentience, when is the car thinking and driving, and when am I thinking and driving? So that's a tangible example.
So one of the things that I think is really important about this example of the autonomous self-driving vehicle, the Google example of it, is that the LiDAR does not replace other pieces of technology in the car in terms of making that process computable. The LiDAR adds to it, and it's the interaction between that LiDAR technology with the maps and the computability in the car and the GPS systems, etc., that then turned a process that previously would have been thought to be something from science fiction, not computable in our generation, into a real reality that people are really seriously thinking about how it's going to impact not only the automobile industry, but also people's commutes and the entertainment sector. Now that all of this free time is unlocked, all this commute time is unlocked and possibly made available. The insurance industry, how we tax roads, all of these questions and the implications of this technology. But it's this interaction factor that I think is so interesting.
The fundamental thing that a lot of people are aware of is the cheapening cost of compute power, Moore's law, doubling every 18 months for the same price point and so forth. And Gordon Bell, who was a contemporary of Gordon Moore, came up with this notion of Bell's law. So every 5 to 7 years, you see a new computer class born. So they go from mainframe computers to mini computers to personal computers to smartphones. And now we have embedded computing and sensors and things like that, the Internet of Things. And every time one of those computer classes comes along, you have an unbelievable expansion, the ability to move sentience around, to compute things you couldn't compute before, to change the economics of things.
John, let's back up a little bit. We've been talking about applications of computability and where we see it really taking off in ways that maybe wouldn't have been expected. But when we talk about the example of the autonomous self-driving vehicle, what's actually happening underneath the covers in terms of what those technologies allow human beings to be able to then actually see and then convert?
Sure. The critical parts of computability, I think of it as threefold. One is, what's our level of knowledge of the task? So do we have good science about what is going on? And that's a critical part. Then the second piece is digitization. Is it actually digital? Can we manipulate it and so forth? And the third thing is the cost of computability, because we've got some things that, theoretically you can compute them, but there's such a big problem space that they actually can't be done effectively or efficiently or even in human time, right? It might take you a century to do it or something. So those are important things. So an example of something that's not like this, if you look at drug interactions in the body. So there's some people out there saying, oh, if we apply machine intelligence to these, diagnostic-related groups and, millions and billions of health records and so forth, we'll find a cure for cancer or how drugs work. Well, I'm very skeptical about that, because our level of knowledge of how the human body works is actually very low in lots of ways. So let's take something like the drug effect when you take any kind of, antibiotic or, SSRI or, antidepressant or anything like that. We have only limited knowledge of how that works. Many of these drugs, when they were in test, will exhibit placebo effects. So somebody who's taking a drug that has a pill that has no drug in it will have many of the same effects. And these are material. Sometimes they're as much as 20 or 50% of the underlying effect is a placebo effect. So if we have something that major where we don't know how the placebo effect works, we don't know where it sits in the body, we don't know how beliefs turn into chemistry, and then that chemistry helps you out. We have no idea how any of that stuff works. So we can munch patient records till the cows come home. We're never going to figure that out, no matter how much machine intelligence we put on it, because our underlying understanding of the phenomenon of interest is very, very low. You compare that to something like predictive maintenance on your washing machine. So a lot of people talking about, gee, we're going to do the same things with washing machines that GE and Pratt & Whitney have been doing with the jet engines forever, which is monitor them in real time and then be able to predict when they're going to go down, do preventive maintenance, and so forth. Will that work with machine intelligence? All day long, because our understanding of the physics of a washing machine is actually very, very good. So it's important to separate those two things out. And then this last thing about the digitization. So there are a number of analog control systems out there. Like if you think about a steam engine in the old days, there's a Watts governor that due to centrifugal force, as the engine got going faster and faster, the Watts governor would actually slow down the amount of fuel going into the into the steam engine. And that's not a computable space because there's only that local feedback loop between the physical movement of the governor and the change in the behavior of the steam engine. What's nice in the digital space, and you can apply machine intelligence, is when you have a symbolic description of it, you can actually learn from it, because while it's doing the thing at hand, that is changing the state of the steam engine, you can actually be watching it and deriving management information. When did it happen? What's the degree of it? You know, what are the degrees in the steam engine? What does that mean? And so forth. So you've got all this managerial information that gets birthed once something becomes digitized. So it's really those three things together.
Let me play back to both of you what I think you're saying. Because it's not quite clear what the real news is. And it sounds like the real news is that every 7 years or so, the world gains another level of things that are sentient. They're kind of computable. They're embedded with sort of digital technology. And every time we cross one of those thresholds, every time humanity crosses one of those thresholds, the economics change of, you know, what companies can do changes, opportunities for companies change, the economic structure of the society at large may change in some ways. And there's a kind of intrinsic nature, you know, one or two more steps into like Toontown, I guess, or a place where, you know, we're just surrounded by, you know, sentient accounting systems, sentient credit scorers, sentient homes, sentient automobiles, sentient thermostats, sentient internets of things.
Absolutely.
And the progress made towards that is under-tracked and not really understood. Mm-hmm. It's not understood as a progression. And therefore, people are not predicting, investing, setting up the kinds of organizations that can deal with it, and getting ready for it.
I think that one of the things that we lose track of is exactly this issue that when you get a new computing class, when you get a new set of processes or tasks or products that go from being uncomputable to computable, you get a whole set of information and of cycling of feedback that you never had before. And that information and cycling of feedback puts a task, a process, a formerly uncomputable thing into the computability sphere and suddenly jumps it onto a computability improvement curve. So whereas before, if a process was handled manually, as John used the example of his mortgage broker, that mortgage broker may have originated a certain number of loans over the course of a month and would not know whether a person that he had taken a risk on wasn't paying back then until a year perhaps before a year after they go into arrears. The feedback cycle of information that happens in a world that's happening mostly manually is much slower, so that the accumulation of pattern isn't identifiable in a reasonable time frame. When you move into a computability space, suddenly the feedback cycles get magnified, by many orders of magnitude faster. And you can start identifying the patterns that then allow you to see where you can start improving it. And not just having that process be a replication of the way we do it in the real world, but a replacement of what we do in the real world.
What I think is happening more broadly is, as management practice and as investment practice, is what it used to be just the realm of a few smart, practical futurists now becomes management practice. Those people who really understand the economics of sentience are going to be able to set a different kind of table in terms of the returns to capital and their competitive market power. So to give you an example, when the auto companies now are really thinking through what does it mean to have a self-driving car? The smart ones are actually decomposing the kinds of activities you have. And they're starting to think about the full transportation set. So leisure, what you might have done with a bike, family, parking, you name it, all the different components. And what's happening is that as they think about the development of the self-driving car, they're saying, okay, where are the value patterns going to be? And how are those going to get traded in an active market? Mm-hmm. So, for example, what would it mean to buying a new car if you knew you could lease that car into the on-demand network when you're not using it? So you go to the airport, you're going to be gone for a week. car drives itself someplace, puts itself into the marketplace. You have the right kind of controls for, and you know, insurance for if somebody, you know, ruins the interior of the car or whatever, right? Those are covered. And then you come back and the car parks itself in time for you to drive home or be driven home. You know, now the car companies now are thinking through, okay, well, what does that mean to everything? What does that mean to a car loan? What does that mean to a car lease? What does that mean to pricing? How do I think about the structure of pricing? So they're really rethinking the fundamentals based on the computability and then the market trading when you have sentience in the car itself.
Plus, it's not your car anymore. It's really its own car.
That's a great way to think about it. It is its own car. So let's take something like a building. So buildings today, with the exception of very few, are not sentient, right? They don't have a digital description of their state, a symbolic description of their state. They really can't change that many parameters. And most of the factors in a building, not all, are essentially one-way flows into the building or the exhaust coming out of a building. Well, now, as buildings become smarter and part of the power grid, and just about every person who's looking to the future of energy says buildings will be both consumers and producers of energy, just like your home, many homes are today. So, okay, now it's a two-way flow. The building is aware of itself. The building can look at its own behavior over time. Okay, what are the demand patterns for me? So you have a building that is a building in support of leisure. It's going to have high demand patterns on the weekends and low during the week. And one that's in support of work is going to have high demand patterns, depending upon your work, high demand patterns during the week and low on the weekends. Well, okay, now I have a symbolic model of my behavior as a building, and I can start to look at the ebbs and flows of what I need. Okay, can I give the power out to the grid? Do I have to bring the power in from the grid? You know, can I think about opening up parking spaces that are just sitting on the weekend and put them into the marketplace of parking spaces? You know, I start to think about, you know, do I do temporary leases? Okay, are there other people who would want to come in on the weekend? Again, with all the risk parameters and so forth. But these are the kind of things that can happen when you have sentience, because you can then put things into a market. And when you put things into a market, you really have a totally different dynamic.
All of this is happening without a human decision maker. In other words, there's no building owner who's saying, let me lease those parking spaces or what have you.
The way I think about the kind of who's in charge is, think about a modern fighter plane. Not that I've ever been in one, but what happens in a modern war plane? In a modern war plane, sometimes the pilot is driving, sometimes the plane is driving. Sometimes the pilot's driving is using the weapon system, sometimes the weapon systems are on automatic. It's that notion of dynamic allocation of sentience, like who's doing the thinking? Am I, or is the machine, or some combo? And to have that dynamically allocated based on capacity and context. So if you're busy running the weapon system, it'd be good to have the plane run itself. And so it's that kind of thing. So traditionally, one of the big things about symbolic automation where we are today is, historically, we've always thought about, in traditional automation, taking decision rights from the human and stuffing them into the machine. It's a one-way street. This is really a two-way street. Because with cognitive automation, with sentience, with computability, you have the ability to dynamically allocate that thinking.
What's the difference between sentience and computability? How do those two fit each other?
I was thinking that you can't get sentience without computability.
But you can have computability without
sentience. You can have computability without sentience. But on top of computability, there needs to be an interaction element between components inside of the process or task or physical object. So I'm thinking about the self-driving car as one of the benefits and the possibilities for allowing these vehicles to reduce the accident rate by 90% is not only that inside the car it has these systems that can create this 3D model, but that also these systems can be communicating with each other and making dynamic changes over time. We're using the car as an example, but buildings could talk to each other. One down the street could say, hey, I need a little power here. Hey, I've got extra. In a sentient world, you can have guidelines where it says, in this environment, kind of follow this general rule, this general structure, but you can make a smart decision. You can make a rational decision if circumstances change.
I want to take a leap here. So, Laura, you said that the connected car has computability, which means that it is programmable. Parts of it, its behavior, are translated into an algorithm, and that can happen in a consistent way. And that's important, necessary but not sufficient. And then it has to have interaction. It's part of a larger system. Itself is a system, and the different pieces are communicating with each other. And then that was pretty clear that that in itself is not sufficient. You know, I can be, as a human being, I can be, you know, I can have thoughts that determine my behavior, and I can be in touch with others, and that still doesn't make me sentient. It makes me dangerous. I don't get to be sentient until I care, until I care about the outcome. And a connected car is one that actually has a stake in the outcome. It cares that it's not going 6 feet over the line or 3 feet over the line. And it's not even that it's moving towards a goal. It's somehow all of that computability and interaction is allowing it to make decisions on behalf of some sense of what's right and what's wrong. It might not be what's right and what's wrong. And that's where the economics comes in, right? Because economics is the study of value and worth. And the economics of an institution is the value of what it produces. Now you're talking about a car, a device, a building, potentially a company, potentially a city that is making decisions, being programmed, having its behavior controlled, interacting with others, and also somehow has a sense of why, you know, what it's doing all this for.
Fascinating. So you're almost saying it's got to have a moral compass to be sentient.
Well, I'm really not going that far because it doesn't have a soul.
That's why I said almost. That's why I said almost.
Does a company have a conscience?
Yeah. Well, I mean, so sure. I mean, I think that the tricky bit for me is that where do you draw the line? Because in a certain sense, any intelligent activity with a feedback loop and so forth is in the main, not any, almost all, are optimizing around something they quote-unquote care about. You know, efficiency of gas, closeness of dropping the bomb, you know, whatever. And so I think your description of it invites a kind of general purpose utility that somehow is beyond the mechanical functioning of the activity. So it's not just energy conservation, right? It's something else. Maybe you would say it's sentient if it has some kind of altruistic behavior, you know, somehow in it, right? That it's.
Although we don't want to cross that line either, right? We don't.
Yeah. The useful thing of the concept of sentience is that things we used to think of as devices now actually have behaviors, and that those behaviors are not all prescribed beforehand, but they are contextually adapted. And I think that that's a big difference when you have an actor that can sense its environment, behave and adjust based on future contingencies that we don't yet know. So that for me is kind of the usefulness of the notion of sentience, because that to me invites more than computability.
Yeah.
You know, it's a future unknown adaptability. And to Laura's point, it isn't a defined algorithm in terms of all of its possible future states, right? I mean, computationally it might be, but heuristically, just, you know, the idea that my building is sitting there and it's kind of, you know, learning from the rain and learning from the sun and learning from the environment and learning from the neighborhood and learning from the power grid, and, you know, that to me is something more than just predictive computing on the front end. Right. You know, that, and I think sentience gets close to that.
A sentient entity is less risky than a non-sentient one because it's more in touch with the ways in which something could go wrong? Is that the...
Usually, a sentient entity would be more. I mean, you can have aberrant behavior. I mean, you know, Frankenstein lives, right?
Well, it's Frankenstein's angel in a way instead of Frankenstein's monster.
Fair enough. Frankenstein's angel. That's exactly what it's about. Yeah, and the thing is that a lot of it has to do with the way you design the control systems. If the control systems degrade soft, then I wouldn't say categorically, but I'm pretty sure that it's a lot safer if it's sentient. if the control systems fail hard or fail through aberration, like the building starts acting stupid and doing stupid things, then it makes it worse. So I think sentience amplifies Frankenstein's angel and Frankenstein's monster.
But if the building is learning, right. If the building is self-aware,
right.
And if there's a value on, well, your power grid example is a really good one here, right? Because if there's a value on less emissions and better energy throughput, better energy, less cost per erg,
right.
And less emissions, then the building has a lot of discretion on how to adjust.
Exactly.
It doesn't need a human governor or even a set of rules. It needs guidelines. And it doesn't even need those. It has a programmed sense of what's right or wrong in this context.
Absolutely. Yeah, look, and the thing is, too, compared to where we are today, we have, you know, massive improvements we can have. I mean, we've all seen, and we will see tonight, buildings full of lights on because the building doesn't even have the most basic motion sensors. Okay, you can improve that building a lot just by doing really basic stuff. But when you talk about truly sentient buildings, yeah, I think they are. They're safer, they're better, they learn. They kick out information about how to design the next building or improve itself. These are gross, massive effects, right? If buildings could just tune themselves to the cycle of the week, you're talking about massive changes in availability, energy efficiency, you know, all kinds of things. One of the big features about the current advances in sentience is that they don't have a very brittle intelligence. They have a more robust intelligence. So what I mean by that is if you think about some of the visions of the self-driving cars a long time ago, you had the idea there'd be wires in the roads and the cars would orient themselves around the roads. Well, now the intelligence doesn't need those wires in the roads, right? The idea is that they're, you know, it's like in Back to the Future, where we're going, there are no roads, right? The intelligence is robust enough to adjust. And you see the same thing in robots. If you look at, you know, some of the Boston Dynamics robots that look like dogs and, you know, small rodents and things like that, they're incredibly robust in a hostile environment. They can knock them over, they can go up and down stairs and things like that. So the more sentience there is, usually the more degrees of freedom, that device has for adjusting to its environment.
Whether or not the sentience is Frankenstein's monster or Frankenstein's angel, I think has a lot to do with how accessible the tools of sentience are to humans. I agree with the AI movement that Elon Musk is a part of. As he put it so succinctly, I hope the AI is nice to us. And his answer to that is to not have companies own the AI by themselves, but to have an open ecosystem of sentience and the tools of sentience. And he believes that that's incredibly important to keep the balance so it's Frankenstein's angel, not Frankenstein's monster. And I think he's right about that.
Makes a lot of sense. And I want to say thank you to both of you. This is great. This conversation really makes me want to go and check my credit score. Because I think that sentience is, it's not like this is a future story. This is something that has been being embedded in our world for years. And we think of it as digital technology, or we think of it as better processes or practices. But what it really is the world becoming more self-aware, or more aware, you know, and exactly who is the self in this self-aware system? Well, we're still figuring that out. But it's clearly not a Frankenstein story. It's a story of the evolution of our relationships with each other, which is probably at heart the subject of business and management and the subject of the magazine. So with that, thank you very much for this conversation, and I hope we'll have more.
Thank you, Art.
Thank you.